Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. I, Larry Mueller here. Really pleased to have Melinda Myers back as our guest today. Nationally known gardening expert, TV, radio host, author. She's written over 20 gardening books and has recently released the second edition of a very popular Midwest Gardener's Handbook. All you need to know to plant, and maintain a Midwest garden. So we'll talk with her about how to boost your garden harvest today, among other things, and of course take your questions as well, and I hope you join in. Number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. Again, that's 800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org. Melinda Myers, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Great to be here, Larry. Always enjoy talking to you and all your listeners as well.
Are you tired from the estate fair?
Yeah, a little bit. I'm trying to gain some ground on all those weeds that took over while I was gone. Well, they had a head start before fair, but
yeah,
I blame it on the fair.
I know what you mean. So I looked at some of my tomato plants this morning on my way out the door, and I saw some ones that I should have picked probably a couple days ago. What are some of the more common mistakes we make when we're harvesting vegetables?
You know, you're right. Trying to find that peak time where you get the best flavor and greatest nutritional value. So for tomatoes, when they're fully colored, and then if you can give them 5 to 7 days on the vine, so Larry, maybe you knew this subconsciously, they get a sweeter flavor. But unfortunately, ground squirrels, chipmunks, and squirrels seem to know when they're ripe and take a bite, right? Not out the whole thing. One bite out of one tomato, another bite out of another tomato, and we lose it. So if you need to pick them a little early, granted the flavors are not as good, but at least you'll have some tomatoes to eat, you can ripen them indoors. And that's something we are all doing usually right before that first killing frost, at least me, picking whatever I can, right? And then we put them in a cool, dark place. I like to lay them out on a table with newspaper or, you know, paper grocery bags, spread them out, and then ripen them. And I've been able to have BLTs in December doing that. So, yeah, I compost a few that don't make it. But, you know, but again, at peak. With peppers, sweet peppers, we pick them when they're full-size, blocky. If we leave them on and we let them get red, they'll have a sweeter flavor and actually are higher in antioxidants. I usually can't wait that long. I have a few recipes I need my sweet peppers for, right? Most hot peppers, we wait until they color up, except for jalapenos, chiles, and Anaheims, we usually harvest green. As they get red, they may get a little warmer in flavor. You can still eat them. It's just getting that maximum flavor out of the vegetables you're harvesting. And when I was at fair and we were talking harvesting zucchinis, you know, the bar type, that's always one to keep up on, right? A couple days later, it goes from 10 inches, which is perfect, to baseball bat size. And I learned this from you, Larry, that if you do grow baseball bat-sized zucchinis, plan for leave a zucchini on your neighbor's front porch night. But we missed that. That was August 8th, so no point in growing them big. So harvesting regularly any of your vegetables increases productivity. And my favorite is cabbage, you know, because a cabbage takes up about a square foot. And I remember I had a secretary when I worked at Extension. She goes, I don't get it. You know, one head of cabbage from one plant. Well, cut just the head off when it's mature, full-size, firm, leave the lower leaves, and you'll get 4 or 5 small heads of cabbage forming.
So you
can expand in that one square foot. So it's a great way to get maximum flavor and increase productivity.
This is just thinking, Jill was telling me a story about the woman who left a zucchini in her car and went shopping. When she got back, she found someone had broken in and left her 3 more.
Oh, no. I've never heard that. Thank you, Jill. That's a great story. I will pass along. Don't leave your zucchini in out of view.
You know, what I do when I have too many, I can make, there's some hot dishes that I make that I can freeze, you know, zucchini, and there's cheese involved and some other things. There might be hamburger in there too, whatever. And then I can freeze them and pull them out in the, when it gets colder, and I don't have any more zucchinis.
And that's a great idea. And a lot of people are using zucchini noodles instead of pasta. Yeah. And when I worked for Extension, we had an urban garden program, and I'm trying to find my zucchini recipe book because they had everything from pancakes to all kinds of dishes, like you were saying, that you could make with your zucchini because you get so much. And I'm like you. I freeze a lot of it because, you know, come January, I'm missing the zucchini. August, I'm probably starting to get my fill, but that's okay, you know. Winters are long.
Got a recipe, someone who made it, whoever thought it up, called it Zoo Beefy, and it's one of my favorites.
Ooh.
I love it. Again, it's zucchini and hamburger and a lot of cheese. It's hard to go wrong when you got a lot of cheese in there. Yeah, and it freezes. It freezes pretty well, too, which is...
Well, and you know, that's amazing. A friend of mine gave me a recipe for smothered cabbage, which is cabbage, yellow potatoes, onions, and I'm trying to think what else, and you cook it, and we froze it, just I wasn't sure, and the cabbage kind of had the consistency of noodles when we thawed it out. And I was like, well, it was very tasty, you know. It's one of those things, there's two of us, and I make dishes for six. To prevent us from eating all six servings, I try to freeze some. And, you know, you're right. Sometimes you freeze it and you find out, oh, this really worked well.
So cucumbers, I made nice cucumber salad the other night. What about, is it just looking at the size of the cucumber to figure out when to pick it? That's kind of what I do.
Yeah, and how you're going to use it. Great question. So if you're going to do sweet pickles, you know, typically 1.5 to 2.5 inches. Think about those sweet pickles you buy in the jar. Dills, you let get a little bit bigger, like 3 inches. Slicers, about 8 inches. The burpless type are bred so that they can be a little longer without having the big seeds and the tough rind. Sometimes when we're experiencing drought, which then can influence nutrient uptake, you'll see cucumbers that are misshapen. If you let them go too long, they turn yellow. And so you've let them go too long, and you may need to find some other use for them, like a lot of sugar or pickling or something. But you're right. Look at them and think about how you're going to use them. And that's a great way to do it, to make sure you get the best flavor out of those as well.
So, a few questions coming in, and some callers online, too. I'm having just a little bit of an issue with calls, but we're getting them in there. Jennifer in Madison emailed, she has an office with no windows. The fluorescent lights automatically turn off when she leaves for the day. So between 5 p.m. and 7 a.m., that's dark. She has one small snake plant that she says she's managed to not kill in the last year. What are some other indoor plants that thrive in a windowless office?
You know, that's such a great question, Jennifer. And plants really help our mental state, our creativity, our focus. My daughter is a therapist, and she has an office with no windows, and we bought LED lights for her because she started putting plants in for her own health and her patients' mental health. So you might want to look at some of the LED plant lights. They've really come down in price. Many look like good furniture. You might set a trend in your office as well. But the low-light plants, snake plants actually really like good bright light. But as you found out, Jennifer, they tolerate low light. Cast iron or saloon plant, often grown as a ground cover down south. It's called that because it would be found in bars, saloons, where it's smoky, dusty, and no light. So a cast iron plant, Aspidistra, that's a good one. Philodendrons usually tolerate pretty low light in that kind of fluorescent environment, so you might want to try some of those as well. ZZ plant, you see it a lot in hotels and airports.
Yeah.
That's another, right? Another not only low light, but a good drought-tolerant plant. So it really, those long weekends, especially in the winter when the heat's on and the air's so dry. Drought tolerance is something else to consider. So I would check those out and get started with those. And then, you know, you find a philodendron you like. The ones that are variegated may not have such bright variegation in low light, but there's lots of new varieties. There's upright types, there's trailing types, so that you can do that. And then check out some of those plant lights. I do some work with Gardener Supply, so I want to disclose that. But even if you just check it out, they have a lot of furniture-grade shelving units that are cool, and also standalone lights. And then, you know, then even just lights you could clip on to stand and then shine down on your plants can really increase your gardening opportunities.
Greg in Waupaca has a question for us, I believe. Greg, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead.
Yeah, I inherited a set of kiwi plants from my father-in-law 20 years ago, and he told me that there's a male and female kiwi plant that once they meet in the middle, they will propagate fruit. They have not. What do you suggest?
I'm laughing, Greg, because I have kiwi plants that are like 10 years old, and your father was right. You need a male near a female, at least one male for every 1 to 5 female plants for pollination to occur, for fruit to form. And we treat kiwi, we prune them much like grapes so that we can contain the vines. And I thought mine died in a late frost, so I added more. They survived, and so now I have a ton of kiwis. And this is the first year I had flowers, and I have about what I can see, about 4 or 5 fruit. And I keep checking to make sure the birds haven't gotten them. They haven't ripened yet. So one of the hard things is knowing which are male and female. So the only way you can tell without a tag and know it was reliable is looking at the flowers. And some are self-fertile, but most of the hardy ones are not. And so it's waiting to make sure they bloom at the same time and then check for fruit. And I'll tell you, hard pruning, much like grapes, will open them up, better light penetration, air circulation, though I didn't get mine pruned this year, and it's the first year I had flowers. So maybe, you know, what the books say my plant's not listening to. And patience, and it sounds like you've had 20 years of waiting. So if you look up grape pruning, UW Extension has a great brochure, Growing Grapes in Wisconsin, talks about different pruning systems, but you're basically pruning like you would grapes to control the size of the vines, open them up, and then and you do that March, kind of before growing season begins. And if you haven't fertilized, you might want to do a soil test. You know, too much nitrogen, you'll have even bigger plants and less likely fruit, but you may need to give it a little boost, you know, a little low nitrogen, slow release fertilizer. But find out first with a soil test, because we want to make sure we're going to encourage fruit and not discourage it. So hopefully the male didn't die or the female didn't die, so that you have both genders out there pollinating, so you get pollination.
There you go, Greg. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Rich in Middleton, we'll go to you. Hi, Rich.
I've had some leaf mulch. I used my mulching lawnmower to chop up leaves and mulch leaves in the fall of the year, and I put them in a bag. And then I use it for mulch around, like this year, particularly heavy coat on my raspberries, and they're not composted yet. They're just chewed up. I understand that composting, you really need some nitrogen for something like that. So should I be putting some liquid nitrogen or high nitrogen fertilizer on with that leaf mulch that you put down?
You know, if you're, I love leaf mulch. I find it's one of the best mulch is free because you're getting it from your leaves. A layer really helps suppress the weeds. And since you're using it as mulch, you really don't need to speed decomposition. It will gradually decompose over time, adding nutrients and organic matter. And then, you know, all the, you know, ground beetles and everything like that will help pull it into the soil. Because you're really trying to, I'm guessing, with the leaf mulch, you're trying to suppress the weeds. And as it breaks down naturally, it will improve the soil. So you don't need to add any additional nitrogen, because if you're using it as a mulch, you want it to last. And usually after a season, season and a half or two, they'll break down naturally. So we only need, when we're composting, that's more when we're adding it to the soil. Some people do top dress their gardens with compost. It's a great way to do it, but I think with your raspberries, you're trying to suppress the weeds. So I would leave the leaves as is, let them naturally decompose, and add more as needed. And I think that'll help you with some of those weed problems we all seem to get in our raspberry patches.
Thank you, Rich, for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. We'll get you on pretty quickly with your gardening question. Or email. Lots of folks emailing to ideas@WPR.org. Maria Lopez and Tyler Ditter, our engineers today. Jill Nadeau, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. And you're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Melinda Myers, as we talk gardening. And again, you can join us, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@WPR.org. Jennifer in Madison emailed. She thinks her apple tree has leaf rust. The leaves have been spotty yellow for some time, falling for a few weeks. She knows to pre-treat next spring, thanks to a previous episode of Garden Talk. Many of her apples don't look great, but she'd like to know if the ones that do are okay to eat.
And I've been getting lots of calls about apple cedar apple rust, which, as she knows, but we'll share it with others, that it's a disease that needs two different hosts, red cedar, which is a type of juniper, and either a quince, an apple, a hawthorn. And so in the spring, when we get a warm rain, usually the end of May, you see your, it looks like your juniper's been slimed and it's kind of this gelatinous horns. They release spores onto our apples and hawthorns and quinces. And then that gets the spots that she's seeing. Then they release spores back to the juniper. So removing one of the hosts is the best solution. However, usually it's somebody else's juniper, somebody else's apple, right?
Yep.
So she knows to treat when the plant ahead of time to protect, so that's good. And there's great information on timing and products on the UW Extension website. And so raking up those leaves and those apples, just cutting out the bad parts, the ones that aren't, that look good, are, you can definitely use. So, and even just removing, often it's just at the surface of the fruit. So
yeah,
removing and peeling the outer peel, and the inside's fine. It's putsy, but you'll still have some apples that you can use for baking and the sauce and eating fresh.
Sure thing. Dan emailed. He has a Black Beauty eggplant plant that has 5 to 6 fruits on it. At what size are the fruits ready to pick? One of them's about 3 inches long and wide and hasn't grown a lot in the past 3 weeks.
You know, and my Black Beauties are looking like round, big round globs as opposed to being elongated. And the ground squirrels love my my long Japanese eggplant, but they don't say, I'll take a bite out of these and then leave them. So I'm thinking the flavor's not where I want it. So typically with eggplant, and I think eggplants are always hard to figure out, you want that rind nice and shiny. You take your thumb and gently press, just a slight indentation, it's ready to harvest. A big one, you waited too long. You can still eat it, but it's a little mealy. Last year, I had problems with my eggplants. Never seemed to get, they seemed to go from underripe to overripe. They never really had the right texture. I still used them. I just didn't have the best flavor, so I used them in dishes where I had tomatoes or peppers or other veggies that kind of helped. It gave it the texture I was looking for, but, you know, the flavor was there, but not ultimate. So this heat we've had has been really, and I want to make sure to talk a little bit about the impact on tomatoes and peppers and even squash plants with the heat. But yeah, so I would take, do the thumb test. You might even want to harvest one, cut it and see what's happening inside. You know, I was finding I had a lot of the green flesh and seeds forming already, even though it was still pretty hard and didn't seem to grow. And so I was just harvesting and using those. Weather really, I think, has a great impact on all our veggies, but eggplants seem to be very, very sensitive. The other ones to consider, there are two All-America selections. One's called Hansel and one's called Gretel. One's purple and one's white, and they're finger-size eggplant. And what's cool about these is, let's say they're perfectly mature on Tuesday, but you don't harvest them till Friday. They hold their flavor and texture for a good 5 to 7 days. And I find that a nice feature about eggplant. I'm trying a new All-America selection this year called Icicle. I started it from seed a little late, and it's twice the size of my eggplants I bought as transplants, and I'm just starting to get long white eggplants. And so they're just, I know. And the flavor, I know, it's an All-America selection, so it's been tested, got great reviews, so I'm anxious to give this a try. And it's up a little higher on the plant, so I'm hoping the ground squirrels decide to eat the low-hanging fruit instead. So I'll let you guys know how it tastes.
Okay. Well, it's got me thinking about my eggplant parmesan recipe, which I love. And that's another one. You can freeze that so easily. Tomato sauce and cheese involved in this, but and some parmesan, but it really freezes well.
You know, and that's such a great, last year, I used to do a lot of canning, and I always tell people when I was in the city and I didn't have air conditioning, it seemed like it'd be 3 in the morning, 95 degrees, I'm canning. And I kind of went, ugh. So now I do more freezing, and you're right, you can cook more, freeze it, and then come January, December, February, when you're dying for garden fresh veggies, you pull it out. And that's such great advice, Larry. And I love hearing what dishes work for you and
yeah.
others, right? You don't think about freezing it. You're like, oh, that's a good idea.
Well, Cal in Sugar Camp will give you a chance. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, hi. I just had two comments. My grandmother used to pull up her tomato plants after the first light frost. So tomatoes on the plant weren't frozen, and she would hang them up in the garage. And I finally figured out, and we would have tomatoes almost all the way up through December. And I was thinking about it, and I thought, well, it must be because the heat of the ground underneath the slab in the garage, as long as you keep the garage door closed, it would keep it warmer inside because the ground loses its heat a lot more slowly if it's not getting hit by cold wind or snow or anything. And the tomatoes were delicious. And the other thing was that to keep me cheery during the winter, I always bring in some of those little elfin impatiens, and they will bloom their hearts out all winter.
Good comments. What do you think, Melinda?
The tomato thing, excellent. I know gardeners that do that with their peppers as well, and a way to kind of extend that pepper season and even let some of those hot peppers dry on the plant. And then I love the idea about the impatience. You know, winters are long, and, you know, if you don't want to bring the whole plant in, take cuttings. And this is a great, end of August is a good time to take cuttings from some of those things and root them. The growth is fresh, and you have smaller plants, less likely to bring in insects and disease. But what great advice. Just something flowering in your home just elevates your spirit. So you've motivated me. I have a couple things that I think I need to take some cuttings to bring inside. So thanks.
Thanks, Cal. Appreciate the call. Oh, man. Nancy in Grafton, your turn. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I'm looking out the window across the street from my house, and there are those great big, what are those big white things that are all over now? They're all blossoming, and they're huge. They're big, sharp, like a shrub thing. And some people have some that have pink on them. They're kind of, are they ever pretty. But I don't know when you would buy them and transplant them or whatever you can do with them. Because, boy, are they ever pretty. But they're big enough for a shrub, for a hedge, you know. So I don't know what they're called.
Yeah, it sounds like hydrangeas. The panicle hydrangeas start blooming around midsummer, depending on the variety, and then it goes through till fall, and the flowers start out, most of them start out white, and then they fade to pink, and some to like a strawberry red. There are some like Bobo that are just a couple feet tall. limelight, which starts out kind of lime green, goes to creamy white, and then to pink, and then to a darker rosy pink. That one can get up to 12 feet tall. We had one at our state fair garden at We Energy Energy Park, where I speak, and we had to cut it back because it was blocking the view from information to the wristband. We were going to dig it out, and then we, you know, being plant people, we went, well, let's just prune it severely. We're going to have to keep pruning it. I think we're going to end up moving it, because it really, keeping a 12-foot-tall shrub down to 5 feet, you know, it seemed like a good idea when we put it in. Let me just say that. And everybody loved it. So I think we're going to replace it. So the good news is, on Proven Winners website, for those that are looking, and obviously they're going to recommend their varieties, but it'll give you an idea. And there's some others from Bailey Nursery. But if you look, they give you the earliest to the latest bloomers and the sizes. And so I think that can help you go, well, I've got a bunch of hydrangeas, and I want to just extend my enjoyment. And so I'm guessing that's what you're seeing are hydrangeas. And they're available at garden centers. You'll find tons of varieties. The panicle ones are hardy to zone 3. Of the hydrangeas, they're the most drought-tolerant. Now, it doesn't mean they're as drought-tolerant as a potentilla, but compared to Annabelle's or the big leaf, they're more drought-tolerant. And there's a ton of sizes available. So, Nancy, check that out. They make great hedges, focal points. The low ones I mix in with perennials for a little bit of year-round, you know, framework and interest. And good and hardy. And some people have problems with deer eating them. I find the deer kind of munch on the seed heads over winter, so they deadhead for me, so to speak. But I think they're finding other things to eat. So that might be one downside that some people see. But I have a lot of deer, and I still have a lot of flowers on my hydrangeas. So it just varies what else they have to eat and how big the population.
Nancy, thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. Gary emailed to ask how to keep cherry tomatoes from cracking.
You know, there are varieties that tend to be more resistant, and I think it's Sweet Million. I'm growing Patio Choice Yellow Cherry Tomato that tends to resist cracking. There's a fun one called Apple Yellow or Yellow Apple that's a yellow cherry shaped kind of like an apple. They say it's an All-America selection, produces up to 1,000 cherry tomatoes per plant. I think it's 2,000. There's tons.
Oh, man.
Cracking is caused on tomatoes quite often, so when that fruit starts forming, the moisture and the temperature influences cell number of cells and the size, and then we get more rain, the plants absorb, and that can lead to cracking. Some are more susceptible to others. So good for all plants, especially tomatoes, is even moisture. So water thoroughly. And with this heat, I talk to a lot of gardeners that we're watering every day, and that's really hard on the plants because those roots form near the surface, and they're more subject to drought, right? Because it gets hot, the roots are right where the soil dries out. We want to water often enough when we plant to keep the roots moist and gradually increase, you know. In clay soil, usually once a week is enough. The temperature's hot, maybe every 5 or 7 days. Sandy soils, a good soaking every 5 days, again, when it's hot, maybe more often. Mulching the soil, that leaf mulch we talked about earlier, is great. And then avoid root damage, because every root we cut, we're reducing the amount of moisture going in. And these things also help with blossom end rot as well as cracking. You can still use the fruit, but, you know, sometimes other insects move in to enjoy it, and it's a little disheartening, and you may have to cut it a little more, especially those cherry tomatoes. That's kind of a pain. Yeah. But those things might help in the future reduce the risk. And then looking for varieties labeled as crack resistant.
And speaking of tomatoes, Jim in Harrisville, I think, has a question relating to them. Jim, hi.
Good morning. Happy, happy. My tomatoes are rotten on the vine from the bottom. They start rotting on the bottom first. Right about the time they're getting ripe.
Yeah.
Okay, so on the fruit, it sounds like blossom end rot.
Yeah.
And blossom end rot is a physiological disorder, so we hang a fancy name on it. It doesn't cure the problem. But it's a... For us, it's a moisture imbalance. If you read a lot of publications, they talk about a calcium deficiency, and it is. But we have plenty of calcium in our soils and our water for the most part. And if you think you're lacking, have a soil test before you buy one of those calcium products. What happens is the plants, when we have moisture, you know, uneven moisture, the plants can't pull up the nutrients as evenly as needed. And so they can't pull up the calcium they need. You get that black spot on the bottom. You can still eat the fruit, but I know it's very frustrating. Cut off the black part, throw it in the compost. It's not a disease. Eat the rest of the fruit. Usually, it's just the first set of fruit, and then we find that the plants kind of are able to kind of correct that, and you don't see as much blossom end rot. I'm growing early resilience tomatoes. It's a Roma tomato that is blossom end rot resistant. So they're starting to find tomato varieties that are blossom end rot resistant. But the good news is you can still eat the fruit. You can just compost the black part. The bad news is you've waited all winter for that tomato. We see it more in containers, obviously, with that, you know, even if you water your pots every day, they dry out, especially with this heat, and so there's a bit of a moisture imbalance. So just kind of mulching your soil, caging and staking at planting to do minimal root disturbance. Be careful as you cultivate around the plants that you don't damage the roots. And then, again, you may want to check for some of those, you know, just do a search on blossom end rot resistant tomatoes. And All America Selection has several of those as well.
Yeah. Jim, thanks for calling. Good luck. Appreciate it. Maddie in Port Washington, your turn. Hi, thanks for calling.
Is this Mary in Port Washington?
Oh, it could well be.
Well,
I've got M-A-T-Y.
Hey, thank you, Larry and Melinda. I have a kind of a curious thing. I was eating an apple the other day, and I found one of the seeds had sprouted. Actually, two of the seeds had sprouted. So I decided I was going to plant them. So I got those little peat moss cups, and I planted them. They grew. They're about an inch tall right now with several leaves on them. But I'm worried, should I put them in the ground before winter or keep them in the house during winter and plant them in spring?
Great, great point, Mary. And sometimes you'll see that with tomatoes as well, that the seeds will start to sprout. And I've never planted them, so thank you. Now I know that you had good success growing. And you know, Mary, but I just want to mention it to others, when we have a hybrid apple, the parentage is different, so the offspring may not come true. So you may end up with a big apple tree because it's not grafted to a dwarf rootstock. You may have an apple that's the same or different than the apple you were eating. But obviously, as gardeners, we like to experiment. So, Mary, I know you're up for adventure. I just want to make sure others aren't disappointed. So the concern is, I have the same concern you do, Mary. We do not have a lot of time to get that plant established. I wouldn't plant it in the ground. I might move it to a bigger pot. And, you know, a plastic pot or container. Give it some room. Is it outside now or still in your house in a window?
It's still in the house. They keep it in a window sill.
Okay. You could try growing it indoors over winter. It's just harder because, you know, they typically like to go dormant in the winter. So what I would do is pot them up in a plastic pot, start getting it used to outside. Then, you know, after a light frost and the leaves drop, I'd put it in, either sink it in the ground in a sheltered location. I'd probably protect it from the animals or move it in my unheated garage. I don't know about you, but I always have plants I don't get in the ground, so I overwinter them in my unheated garage. And that way you could just put a little insulation, maybe set that pot in another pot and put some, you know, non-biodegradable packing peanuts, bubble wrap, something to insulate the roots, water whenever the soil is thawed and dry. So that gives it that cold, but a little bit more moderated. I have to tell you, last year I had stuff overwintered. I start pulling it out, and apparently a vole overwintered in my garage and ate most, you know, dug into the, oh, yeah, it was, it,
oh,
yeah.
Man.
So this year I'm treating with PlantSkid for the voles before I store my plants because I thought you should have eaten them before I put them in storage. So you may, you know, hopefully you don't have that. I've never had that problem. But, Yeah, I think that might be a great way. I'm worried just it'll be too hot and dry to keep them inside. If you've got a cold basement where you can overwinter dahlias and things that stays cold consistently, you could potentially move it down there, you know, keep it cool and dormant. In your window, it'd probably be okay. It's just going to be a little harder to keep it doing well in our warm home.
Mary, good luck. Thank you for calling. And let's go to Janice in Antioch, Illinois. Hi, Janice.
Hi. I have this problem now 2 years in a row. I have a large trellis, and I plant Asian long beans and snow peas together in April, near the end of April. The peas came up really nice. Great crop. There were no beans that came up. I ripped out the snow peas when they were finished and started replanting for fall. And now the Asian beans are starting to come up. I don't understand. Do the peas stop them from sprouting?
You know, very interesting. I'm glad they sprouted. So beans typically need warmer soil than peas. So peas we can put out in the garden earlier in April. If the soil's cold, the beans don't sprout as readily, and usually they rot. And sometimes we'll get a maggot that feeds on the seeds because they're slow to sprout. So I thought you were going to say it didn't. So I think what happened is the soil warmed up. Probably the peas being gone wasn't shading the soil. So next year, what you may want to do is plant your snow peas and then wait until like the middle to the end of May to plant your bean seeds, and then the soil's nice and warm and it should sprout, and then your peas are starting to decline as well. And that might give you both crops earlier rather than having those beans start to sprout now where we only have about, 60 days or less left in the season. But I tried staggering your planting times. That should help with getting those beans up in a more timely manner.
Very good advice. Very good advice. Catherine in Random Lake, some of her potato plants have what looks like small tomatoes growing on them. What are these and are they edible? The potatoes are prairie blush and huckleberry.
Yeah, I'm growing huckleberry for the first time this year, too. I'm excited to harvest. But, Catherine, here's the deal. Some varieties of potatoes will flower and form those fruit. They are not edible. Don't eat them. It doesn't hurt the plant. It's just, you know, they flower and fruit. And so you don't want to eat those. And some varieties are more susceptible or more likely to flower and fruit. You can pick them off if you're worried about kids or pets eating them. You know, energy going into that, usually not an issue, you know, so that you're still getting plenty of energy going into the tubers that are underground. So you see that occasionally and more so with certain varieties than others. So nothing to be concerned about, but don't eat those. They are poisonous.
Melinda Myers, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller, and you are listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with Melinda Myers, nationally known garden expert. And she has produced some wonderful books. And one I like a lot is this new edition, the second edition of the Midwest Gardener's Handbook. All you need to know to plant, plan, plant, and maintain a Midwest garden. Just go to melindamyers.com. You're going to find out some more information about that as well as we move along here today. How's that book doing, by the way, Melinda?
Oh, great. I met a lot of gardeners who have purchased it and felt like the second edition, I was able to address, you know, newer varieties. I removed some plants that we're finding are invasive, added some new plants that are doing well in our area, a couple of things, you know, gardening changes, our climate's changing, and so I was able to address some of those issues. So I always tell people the best part of writing a book is when it's done, of course, and I can talk to gardeners and share what I've learned and from them and research, extension specialists, other plant experts, and just planting myself. And I wanted to mention, Larry, when I did three different talks at Energy Park during State Fair, We Energies, and my handout, I did an expanded handout that's on my website, and it talks about increasing the yield from your garden, container gardening tips, and growing your favorite vegetables. So if you go to my website, Garden How To, under vegetables, it's the top one, says affordable food gardening. Or if you do a search on it, you should come up with an article on affordable food gardening. And that should get you there. And I have a lot of links to resources, some audio and video tips. In my heart is extension. And so I got to give you more to help you be successful.
And what's that website again?
MelindaMyers.com, M-Y-E-R-S.
That is right. And it's a great site. So
Thank you.
Let's go to Don in Bayfield next, Bayfield County. Hi, Don. Don, are you there? Don is not there. Well, let's see. Let's try Nancy in Madison then. Hi, Nancy.
So I have an issue with my tomatoes. It's the third year I've had it on the large tomatoes, not the cherry ones. The large ones have very little meat in them. They've got big spaces of empty.
Weather can be an issue. Heat can cause some of that moisture imbalance also. And part of it is, even if you were watering properly this year, we've had such dramatic heat and then some cooler temperatures. So again, watering thoroughly but less often to encourage good deep roots will help that consistent moisture. Sometimes the heat we can't do anything about, and cool temperatures can also impact how cells grow and divide. And so, you know, last year was pretty hot. The year before was pretty wet. And so you said this is your third year that you've seen this problem. What kind of tomato are you doing? Is it on a bunch of different types? Several varieties?
No, this year it's beefsteak, but before it was Roma's. For 2 years it was Roma's, so I didn't plant them. I did beefsteak this year, and I cut one yesterday, and big hollow spots throughout.
And do you, so how often are you watering your tomato plants?
Pretty much every day, some. Not a lot, but some every day.
So the better thing to do is to water a lot less often. Because I think what's happening is when you water a little bit every day, the roots develop right near the surface. And you're not alone, Nancy. Trust me. I talk to lots of gardeners at the fair, especially with this heat. And so those roots are near the surface, and the soil dries out quickly, and so we get that moisture imbalance. And I'm wondering if that's what you're seeing, especially this last couple years with the heat and the drought. The year before we had rains, and, you know, weather in Wisconsin's always unpredictable. So when we're planting, when we plant our tomatoes, we're going to check them daily, water often enough to keep that root zone moist. And then after a week or two, we're going to start extending that time. So if we're watering every other day, then maybe it'd be every third day, and then eventually every fourth day, and then every fifth day. And one of the things with this heat, you know, if you looked at your garden midday, everything was wilted, right? The leaves are curled. The plants are trying to conserve moisture. And so I always recommend check them again in the evening or early morning, better yet, to see if they've perked up. Because often they'll perk up, it's just the heat, and they're just kind of curling their leaves or wilting to conserve moisture. So next year, try watering thoroughly and less frequently. You're going to have to gradually, you know, start more often with the new plants because their root system's small, but we're training it to have good, deep, robust roots that are more drought tolerant. And I think that's going to definitely help you. And then mulching, you know, that leaf mulch, straw, things like that to help conserve the moisture will also help as well. And Larry, one of the things I wanted to mention about tomatoes, if we have a moment, is the heat this year. You know, usually I tell people you have a poor fruit production, it's because of the cool temperature. With tomatoes and peppers especially, they're very sensitive to temperature. So if we have days over 90, nights over 70, pollen's not as viable. And if we don't have pollen, we don't have pollination, fertilization, and we don't get fruit. If the temperatures are too cool, the same thing happens. If it's below 58, we tend to not have viable pollen. If it's hot and humid, tomatoes are self-fertile, but that pollen can't leave the male part to fertilize the female part. We don't get pollination. So when I was talking to gardeners throughout the fair, I would like, who's having a great year? Half the hands would go up. Who's having the worst year? Half the hands would go up. So part of it was the variety, where you live. You know, we all have slightly different microclimates. And then when you planted, you know, if your plant happened to flower at the right temperature zone, you got lots of tomatoes. If it happened to be really hot, you probably had to wait for the next set of flowers. So it's just crazy. It's just the heat really, you know, was something new for a lot of us. Because
yeah.
usually I'm telling people it's because it's too cool. And this year it's too hot. So,
there
Nancy,
you
just
go.
Try to adjust your watering.
Let's go to Don. Don's back from Bayfield. Let's go there. Hi, Don.
Hello.
Hi, what's Don.
Say, I don't use any calcium nitrate or calcium sulfate in my tomatoes in their pots. But what I've done, I've taken eggshells and ground them up and put them in my tomato pots, and I have no blossom end rot.
Yeah, Don, you bring up a good point. You may not have it if you didn't do that. Eggshells slowly provide little bits of calcium, usually not enough to make a difference, but they do. And Jeff Gilman, G-I-L-L-M-A-N, wrote a couple of excellent books. He used to be with the University of Minnesota. Now he's down in North Carolina. And he did some research on a lot of these. One of his books is The Truth and Myths of Organic Gardening and the Truth and Myths of Garden Remedies. And what he found about eggshells and calcium is, yes, they do contain calcium. The most you get is when you hard-boil eggs and you use that water. And that's where you're going to have the most plant-available calcium. You know what, Don? It doesn't hurt to put them in. And, you know, you obviously are having success, so you're going to continue doing it. And if others try it and they don't have success, it's just, you know, it's just that it's not providing the calcium and it's more of a moisture imbalance. So it sounds like you're doing a lot of things right, Don. So thank you for sharing that, though. And those books for people that like a little bit of understandable science and research-based. Jeff does an easy-to-understand. He tests the things. He does research, a literature search, and then he explains why it does work, you know, and why, yeah. And if it doesn't, why it doesn't. So I find it a fun read and very interesting.
And, Don, thanks again for calling. Sharon in Appleton, we'll give you a chance. Hi.
Hi there. I have an apple tree in my yard. Last year it was overflowing with apples, but the tree is two stories tall, so my husband pruned it this winter.
Oh.
This year we have no apples except the one branch he couldn't reach, and the leaves each have a yellow spot on them.
I can hear the discussion now. Okay.
Yeah.
So, a couple things. Pruning does remove growth, but it can stimulate growth as well, leaf and stem growth. So sometimes when we do a very heavy prune, we end up with lots of leaves and stems and less fruit. Some apple trees are biennial bearers, but you would know that by now. You know, some will have a heavy fruit one year and little the next year or none. We did have, depending on, and I'm not sure in your in Appleton, we did have a late frost by me. So my things were okay. My peach tree, for example, half of the tree lot was frost damaged. I still have some peaches on a few branches. He's setting the stage for the future.
There you go.
I'm trying to help him out here. And I know I keep recommending extension, but there's so much good information we have from the University of Wisconsin, and they've got a great one on pruning apples. And every time I talk about pruning apples, I always feel like you're going to go out with your pruner and go, now, what do I cut? What did she say? And they have nice diagrams. And, you know, you probably have an old apple on a standard, so it's nice and tall, and trying to keep it short is difficult. When you go to an orchard, they're constantly, you know, they start their heavy pruning from the get-go, so it's not that drastic from a huge tree down to a much smaller plant. It will start flowering and fruiting again for you, even those, as long as you didn't cut off all the little spurs, which I'm sure he didn't, just the bigger branches to open things up. So it should start moving into that fruit-producing mode, if not yet next year, the following year. But yeah, you might want to download that brochure for him just in case.
Yeah, that's a really good one. There are a lot, you're right, there are lots of really good extension publications, and they're easy to follow, as you say, line drawings and so forth, that really tell you exactly what to do. So
yeah.
There you go. Melinda Myers, our guest today. Melinda is a nationally known gardening expert, TV and radio host, author, and columnist. She does all kinds of great things for gardeners like you and like me, and I'm always glad to have her with us for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mealer here with my friend and guest, Melinda Myers, nationally known gardening expert, TV and radio host, and author of a number of books. What gardening questions are on your mind? We'd love to hear from you, and we have open lines, so we can get you on pretty quickly. Number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-4234. 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Amy emailed us, Melinda, and said her bird feeders have attracted rabbits, and unfortunately they are eating her flowers up too. She tried three different powder repels and peppermint oil, besides getting rid of the bird feeders, which would make her sad, and putting up small fences or wrapping her trees. Do you have any tips? She says she's lost so much this season to rabbits, and now she's about to lose it herself.
Amy, I feel your pain. We love to have the critters in our landscape. We don't mind sharing some plants with them, but when they eat more than their fair share or are key plants, it's very frustrating. I do work with PlantSkid. It's an organic repellent, and I've had great success with keeping the rabbits, protecting even tulips, my Korean spice viburnum, some of my new plantings. I use the liquid on trees, and I learned this from a gardener who dipped strips of cotton cloth and hang it in there like apple trees, and that odor repels deer, elk, and moose. And then the granular, sprinkling it on the soil and then lightly watering it in, will help take care of voles, chipmunks, and rabbits. They don't guarantee it with ground squirrels. That's one of my big pest problems. Sometimes I get control, sometimes I don't. There are just so many of them. Anytime we can use any repellent, homemade or commercial, before they start feeding, I know that's too late this year, but it might help you before eating habits change going into winter, and also next spring before you do your planting, if you can use a repellent. I get the fencing. You know, I have fence around my big vegetable garden, but I don't have fences around the other plants. It's not practical. Scare tactics, they're not afraid of us. Even nah. I'm out in the country, right? They just look at you and keep eating. So, you know. So you might want to try a different repellent like PlantSkid. You might want to next year do it in advance. I feed the birds too, and so that does bring in some other things like the ground squirrels and the rabbits. I had a rabbit trapped in my big fenced-in area, and the joke was I fed it all winter till I could get it out so it wouldn't eat my plants. So I'm kind of a sucker. You don't want to talk to me about trapping live or otherwise.
Okay. Oh, man. Let's go to Mary in Plover next. Hi, Mary.
Hi there. I have a lot of Brussels sprouts, and someone told me I'm supposed to cut the top off the plant so then more of the, you know, the nutrients go into the sprouts themselves. What am I supposed to do with those things?
I'm glad you brought it up, and I meant to talk about Brussels sprouts when Larry and I were chatting in the beginning. So one of my favorite veggies, not everybody's.
Oh, mine too.
I know. I love them. So Brussels sprouts are a long-season plant, and they'll continue to grow, and then they'll form the sprouts, and they mature from the bottom to the top. So if your plant is getting tall, and they'll tolerate a light frost, even down in the upper 20s, and that improves the flavor on them as well. And so one thing that if it doesn't seem like those sprouts are starting to gain size, that's when towards the end of the growing season, like early September, we'll pinch out the growing tip. That way it won't keep growing tall, producing new sprouts, but rather, just as you were told, put the energy into those that are already formed. We can do that with our indeterminate tomatoes, too. You know, depending on where you are in Wisconsin, frost is end of September, mid-October, and if you've got lots of green tomatoes, because indeterminate tomatoes, flower, fruit, pinching out the growing tip, they put the energy into maturing those tomatoes that have formed and any flowers to form tomatoes. Same with pumpkins and squash. Thought I'd squeeze that in, Mary, so thanks. Sorry, you got way more than you wanted. So I would wait a few more weeks and then make sure you've got plenty of sprouts on the stem, keeping in mind that after a light frost, that flavor only gets better.
Yes.
But yeah, and you don't need to pull the bottom leaves off because the catalogs, you know, that happens sometimes when you start harvesting. If you harvest the sprouts from the bottom up as they mature, you'll accidentally knock off the leaves. The catalogs do that so you see those big, juicy sprouts, right, that you want to eat. And then some of us just pull the whole stalk up, and then we have lots of good-sized Brussels sprouts and lots of mini sprouts near the top. You know, it's kind of easier to pluck off the sprouts sitting in the garage than in the garden when it's, you know, 30 degrees. So something you may want to try, Mary, but enjoy.
Thanks, Mary. Let's go to another Mary in Chippewa Falls this time. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I was looking at my coneflowers, and something on the top just didn't look right. And so I kind of investigated, and it's telling me I either have aster yellows or a virus. There's two different things, but it's telling me to get rid of them, pull them out. And that's my question, because if it's a virus, what's the proper thing to do so I can get this under control?
Most likely, I'm guessing, aster yellows. We see quite a bit of it. Aster yellows is carried by the aster leaf hopper, so it feeds on an infected plant, and then it feeds on a healthy plant. When it sucks the plant juices, it injects this disease. It's a phytoplasmic-like organism. Sounds like I really know what I'm talking about here, but one of the things, they don't have a cure for it. Controlling the leaf hoppers is challenging because they move so quickly. So, and a lot of us that are growing coneflowers are growing them for the pollinators, so we don't want to use insecticides. It won't kill, aster yellows doesn't kill the plant, but it carries the disease. So then it's a source of infection for your healthy plants. And that's one reason we recommend getting rid of aster yellows infected plants so that we don't have the source of disease to spread to healthy plants. With the virus, getting rid of the plants is essential because there's not a cure for it. You might want to have it confirmed by the plant disease diagnostic clinic. With aster yellows, I see sometimes the flowers will the petals won't turn. They turn green. They don't turn color up. Sometimes it can almost look like a smile on the plant. You can have short petals, deformed flowers. Aster yellows, there's a great publication on UW Extension with it shows the list of plants. Carrots can get it. Marigolds can get it. There's a lot of different plants. But knowing for sure you'd really need a lab test, I'm just guessing without seeing it, I would probably think it's aster yellows, but either case, removing the infected plants is the cure, which I know is hard, but coneflowers reseed readily, so you probably have lots of plants to take its place, and getting the infected ones out will then reduce the risk for those seedlings that are going to pop up in the garden next year.
There you go, Mary. Thank you so much for calling. Dennis in Elkhorn, on to you. Hi, Dennis. Or Denise, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Hi, Larry. Longtime listener, first-time caller. My question is, I have an old-fashioned lilac, and I did the every third tri-pass pruning pretty significantly last fall. I fertilized it with Milorganite, but it still didn't get a lot of blooms. How do I increase the blooms on an old-fashioned lilac?
So a couple things. One, make sure that it's getting plenty of sun. Lilacs really do best when they get full day sun. Most books say 6 hours, but I know gardeners, I always say 8, because if I tell you 8, it might go to 6. If I tell you 6, it might be 4. So make sure nothing's grown in that area that's interfering with the sunlight reaching the plant. When pruning, if your plant's really overgrown, and often we see old lilacs with the flowers up, you know, pretty high on big plants, taking out a few of the older stems close to the ground will encourage new growth from the base, also lets more light and air through, and then reducing the height as needed. And then do this over a three-year period, and that will bring the plant down to size, but it won't encourage so much regrowth that you get lots of leaves and stems and no flowers. If you haven't fertilized and the plants aren't in a bed where you've got some, you know, that you're fertilizing your flower beds or things like that, you might want to give it a little bit of a low nitrogen slow release. And the reason I recommend low nitrogen slow release is we don't want to push more leaf and stem growth, but rather flowering. I'm a fan of Milorganite, as you probably all know, and it contains phosphorus. But what they found with research is when the microorganisms release some of the nutrients from the pellets of Milorganite, it releases some of the phosphorus and potassium bound to our soil. And most of our soils are high to excessive in those nutrients, but they're not available to the plant. Phosphorus promotes flowering, fruiting, and root development, potassium hardiness, and disease resistance. So using that or an organic or other low nitrogen slow release might just give it enough of a nudge to get it to start flowering, along with proper pruning, because the flower buds, hopefully, are formed already for next spring's flowering. So you want to be sure you do most of your pruning after bloom if you want the most flowers. It won't hurt to prune it in the winter, but you'll be removing a lot of the growth that will produce flowers if they set flower buds.
Denise, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Rosemary in Wyckoff, Minnesota. On to you. Hi, Rosemary.
Hello. I have a bunch of coffee grounds I've been saving, and I dry them out so they don't get moldy. What can I put those on? And do I put them in the garden, or do I just put them on the flower bed? So what are they good for?
Great question. A little bit of coffee grounds, perfect. It's a good soil amendment. It contains some nutrients. It won't make your soil real acidic. Great in the compost pile. Great in a worm bin. There are a few plants like lettuce that are somewhat sensitive to the coffee, so you want to be careful. Washington State University did an article on coffee grounds. I think I have a link on my website of just concerns that you need to have. But a thin layer is fine. I've seen people that come across bags and bags. They go to the coffee shop, and it formed even a crusty layer over the soil surface so the water couldn't penetrate. So a little bit sprinkled in, lightly work it into the soil, or let the microorganisms and the ground beetles and earthworms take it down, is a great addition to the soil. Otherwise, in your compost pile, even in your house plants, you could sprinkle a little on the soil surface. Just don't overdo.
There you go, Rosemary. Thank you. Let's turn to Sue in Madison. Hi, Sue.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a first-time grower of butternut squash, and I have some out there that are turning the right color now, but I really don't know the timing of when to pick them off the vine, and I read about curing them, and I really don't understand what that means. So if you could help me out, I'd appreciate it.
You bet. So with butternut squash, one of the wonderful things about winter squash is, boy, they last forever,
yeah,
right?
But, you know, love
they're
butternut.
Great. I do too. And I'm kind of changing a lot of my gardening to things that need less effort on my part to store and preserve, the better. And squash is one of them. So when that bottom, you know, where the squash sits on the ground, when it turns from green to, you know, kind of a creamy or creamy orange, starts coloring up, that's when the squash is ready. It will remove easily from the vine. I usually just, curing is just letting it sit in a warm area. Some people leave them out in the field to cure as long as they're not subjected to frost, and then store them in a cool, dark location. And I've had great success doing that. I don't know, Larry, do you have any other tips? Because it sounds like you grow butternut squash as well.
Yeah,
I've had mine last long.
Well, you do what I do, so we're
okay.
Of one mind.
Okay. So, you know, enjoy. And one of the things with squash and heat, I was reading too, because squash and cucumbers and melons, the first flush of flower are male and the second flush are female. And so you have all these flowers and no fruit happening, and you can tell they're female because there's a mini cucumber, mini squash underneath, and they both like slightly different temperatures. And so the weather, I, again, talked to gardeners, some having great harvest and some are still waiting for that fruit to form. So, you know, again, once you get the flowers and fruit forming, if you got enough, pinch out the tips if they're still growing and producing new flowers so that you ripen up what you have.
Thank you, Sue, for calling. Matthew in Wonder Lake, Illinois. Your turn. Hi, Matthew.
Hi, how's it going? Thanks for having me on. I just had a quick question. I work with some pollinator gardens around my community, and I was wondering if I could just take those pods of milkweed and sprinkle them, like, all over my lawn and then get a good native milkweed garden going. Is it that easy to do it? Or, you know, I was just curious as I was on my walk this morning. So thank you very much.
Great question, Matthew. And milkweed is a very, very aggressive plant. And so it sounds like you get it. You're going to convert this whole area to a patch of milkweed. And if you can accept that, that's great. You know, we all want to support the monarchs. And I have to laugh. It seems like the plants do a much better job of planting themselves than when we try to start the plants from seeds and plant them. And so you'll probably have scattered results. But if your soil is bare, now when you say in your lawn, if it's grass, you may not have as good a take because you'll have
right.
the grass competing and you'll have poor seed-to-soil contact. If you have plants growing in the garden, they'll scoot into the yard by rhizome. So it's not that I'm anti-common milkweed. I want to be clear. I have plenty of it on my property. It spreads by seed, but also underground rhizome. And those rhizomes are down as much as a foot deep. And so those plants take up residence, and it's hard to kind of keep them under control. So I just like to tell people that before they think they're going to put three plants in and that's all they're going to have. You know, butterfly weed would be a little more contained if you have good drainage. So you've got to have prepared soil. So the seed, you have good seed or bare soil, I should say, seed to soil contact. That's what the seeds on, you should have good success.
Thanks very much for calling. Dave in Broadhead, your turn. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Larry. Another great show. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I have a question about Brussels sprouts. We had a couple of years that we had good ones. But the last 2 years, last year I had something that was eating the outer leaves of the sprouts, and then when I'd pick them off, I'd get halfway down before I'd get a good sprout. This year, something's eating them right from the bottom all the way up. I have almost nothing. So I'm just curious what it is and what I do about it. And then the other question I had was, I raise kohlrabis. I have a couple of them that are about the size of basketballs because we can't eat them fast enough. But we usually cut them into like chip-sized pieces and put cheese spread them on them or something like that and eat them raw. But if you've got any ideas of other ideas to use kohlrabi.
Okay.
You think about the kohlrabi, Larry, because the outer leaves of your Brussels sprouts, you're probably familiar with the cabbage worms that eat holes in the leaves, and they will go after the outer leaves. That's one possibility. And the good news is you can use something Bacillus thuringiensis kerstaki, which is sold as dipeller thuricide. It's organic, if that's a problem. Also, ground squirrels and rabbits will eat. I had to replant several times and cover the ground squirrels that live inside my fenced in garden. Ate all my kale. They went after a lot of my transplants when they were younger, and I'm wondering if they might be nibbling on it, an animal. So that's where you could use an organic around the bed, like a plant skid that you could use around the planting. That's labeled or a repellent labeled for organic animal control, labeled to use on food crops. So I'm thinking it could be the cabbage worms, but it might be a critter munching on it. And I've seen a lot of pressure from animals with this hot, dry weather. You know, I think they're looking for moisture as much as nutrients. I'm going to confess, Larry, I'm not a huge kohlrabi fan.
I'm not either. I had a friend.
Okay. Sorry, I had a friend, put you on the spot.
Sorry, I had a friend who was loved kohlrabis, and she did the roasting of them with the Parmesan, which sounds like Dave does. But she also made a kohlrabi slaw.
Oh.
That was pretty darn good. And she'd even stir fry with kohlrabi. I remember kohlrabi being in stir fries too. So that's the extent
Thank
of
you.
My
I'm
knowledge.
Sorry. But you brought up roasting, and you know what? Roasting vegetables so changes the flavors. Like radishes, I like radishes
Beets.
But roasted, right? Beets. And so maybe roast, like you said, he might have the best recipe, but thank you. Sorry I put you on the spot, Larry.
There's probably recipes online for kohlrabi slaw. You might try that too, Dave.
That's a great idea.
There you go. That's the best we can do on that. Oh, gosh. Let's see. Bob and Summit, we'll go to you. Hi, Bob.
Hi, thank you. We're growing leeks for the first time this year, and the greens are beautiful, and I'm wondering how we can tell when the leek would be ready to harvest.
You know, leeks are one of my favorite vegetables. I make a leek soup that I freeze, and then we eat it all winter long. So, and I'm not known as a cook, so you know it's got to be easy. And I try not to use a lot of dairy because of allergies, so I use a lot of potatoes. So it's kind of like a leek potato soup. But they'll tolerate a light frost. When the greens will remain nice and green even after a light frost. When the leeks are, between 1 and 2 inches in diameter, you can harvest them at any point and use them when they're ready. And you planted them deep so you have a nice white stem, and that's good. You can even eat the green portion where it transitions. So after a light frost, don't rush to pick those. They'll tolerate it if need be, but harvest as you need them from now on. So once they're reaching that size that you see, you know, a good 2 inches, inch and a half to 2 inches in diameter, they're ready to pull.
There you
or
go.
Dig, I should say. They're, tasty, wonderful homegrown leeks.
Oh, man, they are indeed. And that seems like a good place to wind up on a nice note like that. Melinda, give us your website again. There's so much on it. I love it.
Well, thank you. MelindaMyers.com. And if there's something that's missing that you think we need to cover, let us know. Maybe after I weed my garden and the snow flies, we'll try to make some additions. And we're doing some webinars later this year and personal appearances that are always listed on the website. And I love when people can join me in person.
You can get a whole education. Just go to MelindaMyers.com. You'll get a whole gardening education. Melinda Myers, our guest today. Again, her website, MelindaMyers.com. Thank you for listening and stay with us. We'll talk about the history of Wisconsin fairs with Jerry Apps on Monday and then look at some stories from our state with the editors of Outdoor with our Wisconsin magazine. Thanks for listening. Stay with us.